Welcome to the podcast that is all about self-employment. We'll be sharing expertise on getting started, getting noticed, and getting it right, as well as dealing with getting it wrong. Your host, Julia Kermode, will help you get ahead so you get the success you deserve.
Welcome to today's podcast. I'm delighted to be joined again by Dave Chaplin, and today we're going to cover off a bit more detail in relation to IR35 and how you might be able to tell if you are likely to be working inside or outside IR35. If what I'm saying to you is not making sense, you probably want to go back and listen to the last podcast episode to get up to speed, because this is a bit more advanced than the last one. So, welcome, Dave. Thanks so much for joining me again today. Could you give a very brief introduction about yourself?
Sure. So, my name's Dave Chaplin, and I've been involved in the contracting sector now for more than 20 years. I was a IT contractor myself in the late 90s and into the noughties. In the IT sector, I used to lead teams of developers to build online banks and legal systems. And I formed a website, which is now called Contractor Calculator, in late 1999, based around the IR35 legislation. And that grew over the last 20 years to become what is now called Contractor Calculator. I've been looking at the IR35 issue for the last 20 years and been studying status and the issues around that for 20 years. I helped to defend people in court for IR35 status and visit tax tribunals rather than the cinema, I guess, and watch and watch cases. So it's fair to say that I'm rather obsessed with the topic of IR35.
Great. Well, we're very happy to have you with us and to share some of your obsession with our listeners. Just starting off, so IR35 legislation is basically around whether someone is genuinely in business on their own account or whether they look a bit more like an employee. And we use this kind of vocabulary of being inside IR35. Is that technically even the correct vocabulary? And what does it mean?
Well, no, it's, I mean, there's no phrase in law inside IR35 or outside IR35, but that's what we use. Mm-hmm. The phrase in law would be whether you're a deemed employee or not. Okay. And depending upon whether you're looking at the original legislation or the last piece of legislation, you'll go as far as to say whether the conditions in clause 61MD are met.
Wow.
But essentially, I mean, it gets quite silly, but what we're looking at is we're standing back and we're looking at the relationship between the worker and the person they're doing the work for, and we're seeing if, when we apply the tests associated with employment status, whether or not they would be considered to be an employee in law. Now, this is a massive topic. IR35 status, are you a deemed employee? Inside IR35 means you are a deemed employee, pay all the taxes as if you're an employee. Outside IR35 is used to mean you are not within the legislation, IR35 does not apply, carry on as you are, it's perfectly fine what you're doing.
Okay. So, and so in terms of kind of the factors, now I know that there is so much case law around this, like 20 years worth of case law, so we cannot get into all of that detail. But what I'm hoping we can do is just do a brief skate over what are the key factors that would indicate whether they might be inside or outside IR35 for the work that they're doing. And I think there are three key factors and then some other more peripheral factors, but you tell us.
Sure. Some of the key themes are you providing personal service?
Yeah.
Or are you allowed to substitute? So if you hired, if you're someone who hired someone to come and build an extension on your house, and you hired a building firm, you've hired that firm to deliver the building services to build that garage or extension or whatever it is. And they can send whoever they want. You haven't got You haven't asked that one particular person to do it, and only that person can do it.
Yeah.
So it's a feature of whether or not you are providing services as to whether you can actually substitute and send somebody else in to do the work. Now, this whole bit about substitution is sometimes considered to be a silver bullet. It isn't. It hasn't been since 2011, really, because since a particular case in 2011 called AutoCleanse, judges, when they interpret the contractual paperwork, are allowed to set aside some clauses and basically say they're a sham. So,
right.
Yeah. You know, I remember if we go back to when IR35 was originally introduced around 2000, at that point, there were armies of lawyers creating contracts, shoving in substitution clauses and so on, and using those to just basically say, well, the contract says this, contract is king, it says I can substitute, therefore I am not caught by IR35. Now, if people are still using that same logic now, they are about probably 15 years behind in how the case law has moved on since that point.
Okay.
We have done, I think, almost about 150,000 assessments since we started building tools 10 years ago. Right. And I can tell you that we asked the question about, have you ever substituted? And I can tell you that less than 2% of contractors ever have.
Wow. Okay.
Not that that itself is what's required to prove you have a right of substitution. It is only the right. But again, I'm going into areas of the law here, but you can't just write something into a contract and expect to rely upon that as some sort of magic bullet so that you're outside IR35. You know, the definitions of substitution and what's allowed, what's considered to be a valid one or not, have been laid down in Supreme Court ruling. Actually, it's Court of Appeal ruling for the Pimlico Plumbers.
Yeah.
So it's paragraph 84, if anyone wants to look it up in the Court of Appeal ruling. But you can't just shove in a substitution clause and pretend everything's okay. So that's one of the first factors. The contract is extremely important. The working conditions are extremely important. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely important that both of them marry up and tell the truth.
Yeah.
You cannot contrive situations to try and pretend something is something that it isn't. That would be a very silly thing to do, I think.
Okay. And so we've covered off one of the indicators, which is around personal service and substitution. What are the other key indicators?
So the main indicators actually all stem from a case called Ready Mixed Concrete. The first one is the personal service or substitution aspect. And stemming from that takes us into the area of something called mutuality of obligation, which is a contentious issue. Now, it sounds like a bizarre, weird legal thing, but essentially what mutuality of obligation boils down to is whether or not there is some sort of guarantee of work. So typically in an employment relationship, the deal is that someone is going to guarantee you work for a certain amount of time, and you are going to make yourself available to do that work. You don't necessarily even know what that work is.
Yeah.
What you've done is, the deal is you've said you'll turn up for a certain amount of time. And the deal is that the hirer will pay you as an employee for you making yourself available.
Yeah.
Whether you get given work or not.
Yeah. Okay.
But if they do offer you work, your employer says, do this, you're obliged to do it.
Yeah.
You can't refuse. So that's an employment relationship where two people get together, there's a guarantee of work being offered on an ongoing basis and it being accepted and payment being made, whether work is done or not. That's an employment relationship. So there's lots of mutual obligations going on there. Multiple obligations on both parties. Whereas in a self-employed relationship, you've sort of decided up front what's going to be done. So the building firm, and let's say it's a one-man building firm, one-person building firm. I was so born in the 70s, wasn't I? A one-man building firm. So you definitely want that guy to build that garage because he's got a great reputation and you don't want him to get anyone else to do it. You want him to do it. Right? Well, okay. You've decided up front there that there's going to be some garage building going on.
Yeah.
For starters. And you haven't said, I just want you as a builder to turn up to do building wherever I ask you. And can you build the shed and can you fix the toilet and can you wallpaper upstairs? The deal is you've made an agreement up front that a garage is going to be built. That's the only thing that's going to be done. And you're only going to pay for when that's actually being done.
Yeah.
If the guy just turns up and you'd say, no, can you just sit in the deck chair all day, please, and don't do any building, he can't actually expect to get paid. He only gets paid for work done. So the difference is, so that's a self-employment relationship. Yeah. So the difference is there in this area of mutuality of obligation is the self-employed, the key phrase is you only get paid for work done.
Yeah.
Whereas employees get paid for making themselves available to do work.
Okay.
That's the difference. And what you'll typically see for deemed employees is they probably have a job title, they'll be asked to fulfill a role, they go along with their toolbox of skills, they don't even know what they're going to be doing before they turn up to the contract, and they're expected to do whatever's asked of them. That's classic deemed employment.
Yeah.
Whereas genuine contracting is you know what you're doing before you turn up, and if they ask you to do something else, you just say no, and you only get paid for work being done.
Yeah, and what you just outlined there about the deemed employee does start to feel a bit more like employment if they're kind of just turning up and waiting to be told what to do almost, whereas by contrast, your self-employed garage builder person, you've got the kind of scope or project clearly agreed in advance, and that is what they're being paid for, and almost when they turn up or whatever is irrelevant, apart from in practical terms, of course. But the main fact is you don't pay for that work until you're satisfied that they've delivered it.
That's right. So you've got that. That's absolutely spot on. Now, there's some overlap with mutuality of obligation, which takes us into the next area, which is called control.
Okay.
Now, control is often where the battle is fought into what someone's status really is. And there's an overlap with mutuality of obligation. And control splits down into four factors. Are you being told how to do the work? Are you being told what work to work on?
Mm-hmm.
Are you being told when to do it? And are you being told where to do it? So those are the four main factors. Some of them have different weights in a balancing act. When the judge is considering the big picture. So when we've got to the control point, we have to try and work out whether there is the ultimate right of control lies with the hirer or the client, and whether there is what's being called a sufficient framework of control. Now, typically
I was just going to say, so I think the garage builder example is quite straightforward, isn't it? Because if they're building a garage for me, for example, no way am I going to control how they do it. I will perhaps control where they do it, obviously, but that's kind of in the scope at the outset. So the how and the where. The when, well, it wouldn't really bother me when they did it. So, you know, they could come and do it whenever they want, so long as they do it. So I think there's things that are a bit more straightforward.
You make some very good points there. So let's consider those in the context of the garage building person. And then let's think about how that might compare to someone delivering software services and building a piece of software. So the garagey person, and same with the software person, if we look at the how part of control, we would say that, well, probably they're not instructed about how it's done. Mm-hmm. There's not detailed instructions. And that doesn't mean that's a get out of jail card, because it's considered in law that many people aren't told exactly how to do their work. Mm-hmm. So if you're not told how to do the work, that tends to be a fairly neutral factor. But if you are told how to do it, that's not good. You're more like a deemed employee. So it takes us on to the what. Well, what are you working on? This is a crucial factor, I would say, one of the most crucial factors when it comes to looking at status, because employees are pretty much told what they have to do and are expected to do it, provided it's within reason.
Yeah.
The garage buildy person, no, they're doing the garage. They're going to refuse. And if you ask them to do something else, and the software building person, they will say, well, no, I came in to build this particular thing. You're asking me to work on something else. No, sorry, I'm not going to do that. So the right of refusal to work on other things is a strong indicator that the status is on an inside basis. Sorry, is on an outside basis if you can refuse.
Yeah.
But then we go into the where and the when. And there are, of course, edge cases on this. I guess it depends, and we go into this whole framework of control bit. So if we look at the where, well, if you asked a builder to build a garage for you and they didn't do it where you wanted and built it half a mile down the road, you'd probably be a bit upset, wouldn't you? Whereas with the software person, well, it might be that they can build that at a location of their choice. So they may well have discretion over the location. Mm-hmm. But it might be that the software person is building some military software, and they probably tend to not let you do that at home on your own laptop for security reasons. So there could well be a legitimate reason as to why the location where the work is being done can only be in that location, which is the garage must be at that location. The software must be built at that location, and so on. And if there's a valid reason as to the task essentially constraining where it's having to be done, then we don't need to worry too much about the where aspect.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've signed up to work for a firm and provide your services and they send you all over the country, you don't know where you're going, but you've agreed up front, I'll go wherever you tell me, then they do have control over the where. Yeah. And that could be more of a pointer to employment. So then we go on to the when. Well, if the builder turned up at 4 o'clock in the morning and started building your garage and making a mess and noise, you wouldn't be too happy about it,
no,
would you? So there's some legitimate constraints on that particular one. Whereas the software developer, you wouldn't mind if they were at home and they had a great idea at 4 o'clock in the morning and woke up and started coding away, you'd probably be okay with that. They have more discretion over when they do things. But it might be that they're working at on military software, and it might be that they're working on and have to interface with a mainframe computer, and it might be that they only get 4-hour window a day assigned to them when they can actually do that.
Mm.
In which case, there is a legitimate basis for constraining the when aspect, and therefore it's not really a pointer. So we have to consider all of these factors in the context of what potential control could be had over somebody,
yeah,
and then decide whether or not that control is exercised. And I appreciate that's quite a complex thing for someone to consider, but this work has all been done for them. And firms can use things like IR 35 Shield or, you know, our other competitors and so on to help them understand,
yes,
what these positions are in law.
Yeah. So in terms of control, there are obviously, if you're self-employed, your client has to have a certain amount of control over what you're doing, etc. But my take on how you've just described it is that if there are constraints in and control in how and where and when, etc., someone is, yeah, working, if there is a legitimate reason for those constraints, and to all intents and purposes that individual is still working independently of their client, then those constraints are acceptable. And I guess then other factors may become more important in establishing whether something is inside IR35 or not.
That's absolutely right. So, and that takes us on to what's called stage three of how you evaluate somebody's status, and that's stage three of the ready mix concrete test. So stage one was personal service, yep, with the side bit of mutuality of obligation. Stage two is control. And stage three is, let's put everything in a mixing pot, including looking at other factors like financial risk, equipment, are you part, mm-hmm, and parcel of the organization, and that kind of thing, which are relatively minor factors. And stage three has is supposed to be a negative test to say, well, we've looked at the main factors, but is there anything else here which, when we stand back and we look at the whole picture, says to us, this is actually a relationship that is one of self-employment or employment?
To clarify the fact that these individuals are not employees, but they are contractors, they're engaged on a business-to-business basis. And to change things like, oh, I don't know, contractors can't be included in employee of the month and you know, things like that, because they're not employees. And that's really, really obvious. But you can see how some firms have slipped in how they treat contractors by virtue of wanting to be inclusive and have an inclusive workforce. But actually, that has been detrimental for some contractors, because they start to look more like employees. So I think there is quite a piece around educating firms in that way.
There is definitely a piece around educating firms. It doesn't have to be a particularly large piece. Mm-hmm. They don't need to spend thousands of pounds on consultants to teach them how to hire contractors. Whilst there are lots of firms trying to sell them tons of consultancy, it really isn't that difficult. Where we see the problems arise historically over the last 20 years is we see basically agencies and hirers have taken their eye off the ball.
Yeah.
We see boilerplate contracts that have been cobbled together based on an existing employment contract. So yeah, the drafting of the contracts itself doesn't align with the true status of the contract, which is outside. So we see lots of that. So that, yeah, all needs to be fixed up. That's just a legal issue, and you only need to do it once and keep your eye on the case law so that if things change, maybe you need to slightly tweak your contracts. Mm. But that's something that the firm's advising will do, and the case law doesn't move the goalposts every 3 weeks. So it's just a one-off, really.
It's just admin, isn't it?
And bit of admin, yeah.
Just while we're talking of contracts, and I genuinely don't know the answer to this, and I feel like I should, but can an individual who is selling their services through their limited company, can they provide a contract for their client, or does it normally come from the client to the contractor?
If they're working directly for their client and there's no recruitment agency, then yes, absolutely, they can try to provide their own contract. It depends on the size of the organisation. If the organisation has a formal procurement department and, yeah, and a legal team, then chances are they will probably want to provide their own contract.
Yeah.
But wherever the contract comes from, it's important that the contractor has that reviewed independently of them.
Yeah.
Has someone else look at it for them.
Yeah.
With an eye for not only IR35, but just on a pure commercial basis, really. So that's a key point. The other, going back to organizations needed to be trained. So, okay, we need to fix up the paperwork so that's done properly. The other thing is, it's just, probably the project managers sometimes need to be reminded that the people that they've hired are actually contractors.
Yeah.
And they are not employees. Because they will just think, and there's a reason they think this, they will think that just because two people are sat next to each other doing the same, working on the same type of work, that means that one of them, well, both of them should be employees. Mm-hmm. And the reason they think that is because that's the kind of garbage that's been spread by the Treasury and HMRC and some of their early rhetoric, and it's absolute nonsense. Mm-hmm. The fact that there's two people sat next to each other one is an employee and one is a contractor doesn't suddenly mean that the contractor suddenly becomes an employee. If that was the test in law, we could all pack up and go home and it would just be the test would be two lines. It's a ridiculous notion.
Just on that ridiculous notion, I think the point is that that contractor has the right to refuse work, as one of the points that we said earlier. If their hiring manager said, "Oh, Bob, Fred hasn't come in today. Can you cover part of Fred's role?" Then that contractor has the right to refuse, whereas the employee next to that contractor doesn't have that right to refuse because they're under that mutuality of obligation. They have to do the work that they're given. Is that a sensible way to look at that?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the key differences. But because these hiring managers won't understand the law and they won't understand that actually they won't possibly sometimes even be engaged and even see that there's a different contract. They won't even have read the contracts that the employees sign. They won't have read the contracts that the contractors sign. So they will be relying upon their own common sense. And this is where it all starts to go wrong, because everyone thinks they're a genius at employment status case law. And, you know, I go back to the American physicist again. and what we see is that there's often people mistaking what is in their common sense and what they think is an expectation is completely contrary to the legal and contractual obligations that have been agreed between the parties. And there's a fundamental difference between that. Just because someone expects you to do something doesn't mean that you're obliged to contractually. An expectation is not a legal requirement, and it won't make you fail IR35.
So some of this is really about empowering contractors to be true contractors and to have that ability and that right to refuse. And I think some people who might be new to this might not necessarily realise that is part of one thing. I think they need to always have an eye on, is this really a business-to-business relationship? And if it is, then I must not be treated like an employee, because that could undermine their tax status at the end of the day, couldn't it?
Absolutely, it could. It will undermine their tax status if the old rules apply, and it will undermine the tax status of the client if the new rules apply. And whilst I've been talking about IR35 championing the freelance workforce for the past 20 years, it still staggers me how many contractors don't have any grip on the basics of IR35 and the case law surrounding it, or even just the basics. So contractors need to educate themselves. They cannot rely upon the clients. I would strongly recommend they read my book, IR35 and Off Payroll Explained, so that they can manage their own clients to make sure that things don't slip up, because they can't expect to be nannied on this by their clients or the agencies. They're running their own business. They're in charge of their own professional destiny, and they need to educate themselves on this aspect.
Yeah, it's so important, isn't it? And of course, if someone is working outside of IR35, once these changes come in next year, then their client is not going to want to undermine that outside status, because then they've potentially got tax liabilities there. So I think the contractors need to remember that there is kind of willingness on both sides to make it work in an outside IR35 way, if they are genuinely outside IR35, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest thing to police is to for contractors and clients is to just to refuse to work on anything that wasn't originally agreed. That's the simplest thing. Define the scope of the work up front. I'm not going to start using the phrase statement of work as some sort of silver bullet, because it isn't. And we've had contracts and schedules and things in place for the last 20 years. The fact that someone's just decided to give it a name doesn't make it a brand new thing. Agree the work up front, have that written down in the schedule of the contract, and adhere to that. and don't move outside of what you've originally agreed, and everything will be absolutely fine. There's just nothing to worry about.
And
there's lots of scaremongering, but you know, typically that's just done by insurance companies. You just want to flog your insurance, but there's really nothing to worry about. If you look at the cases that have gone through the courts, it's really not that difficult, this one.
No. And if the basis of your original engagement changes, so say my garage man does a wonderful job of building me a garage and I then want an extension, that's fine. And then we then agree kind of another project plan, if you like, for that extended work. And so for contractors, if they're taken on to build a particular piece of software and they do that and they then get offered further work, they need to make sure that that is agreed in a new contract to avoid the possibility of ongoing work looking like a mutuality of obligation or an employment relationship.
Yes, if the if there's a new project to work on, then have new paperwork. It's that simple, really. I mean, there's two cases that spring to mind on this. There's the JLJ Services case, which was the split decision. That was one where basically the company and the contractor got lazy with the paperwork. So halfway through, they just decided not to keep it up to date when projects were changed. And that's why the second half of that contract was considered inside. The other one is the case I worked on personally and helped co-defend in court. That's the Rauch Consulting case. That's the most recent IT case that has successfully been defended in court as being outside I-35. And in that particular instance, the contractor was working on a series of assignments, and each one was put into a separate schedule, and that was key, actually, I think, as part of the reason why that was found to be outside IR35, amongst other things.
It is important to point out that there is that status dispute resolution process. The way HMRC have put the law together around this is that clients have to have a process, but they don't say what that process looks like or what constitutes a fair process. So I think that's probably why you feel that it's probably a bit not worthwhile.
Well, yes. I mean, asking people to mark their own homework, particularly if they've put in a good process, unless there's really a genuine material reason as to why it's been done wrong, then there shouldn't really be a dispute. Prevention's always better than cure. And if the firm has put in very good process for how it goes about doing its determinations, you shouldn't need a dispute resolution process. It's the answer is the answer. And, and if you have engaged the contractor in that process as well, and they have agreed that the information provided that's going to go into the assessment is correct, the answer is the answer, and there shouldn't be all of these squabbles.
No.
So it's prevention is better than cure, and if companies end up with a large numbers of disputes, then they've probably done something wrong in terms of how they're doing their original assessments.
Yeah. Okay, and then just to kind of wrap things up a bit then, what would be your top tips to listeners, and how would they be best to prepare for next changes, and any kind of tips at all?
Well, I think if you're, for contractors, if you're in a contract that is going to overlap April the 6th, 2021, then it's important to start speaking to the client to find out what their plans are. Because you might decide that you don't want to work for that client anymore, or you might decide that they've got it sussed, they're happy to hire you on an outside basis, in which case strap yourself to that seat and stay there.
Or of course they might discover that their client has no idea this is even coming.
There's definitely going to be the situation where you're asked the client, what are you doing about IR35? And they say, IR35 what? They won't have any idea, in which case you need to start educating the client. But it's going to be the biggest game of musical chairs, which we were seeing happen last time at the dress rehearsal. And there will be winners and losers. There will be scars for companies, depends who has the biggest scars. And preparation is key. particularly for companies that have projects that are currently sourced or quoted for and budgeted for, and they are hiring contractors at the moment that they're going to be in law on an inside IR35 basis, because then they're going to have a problem, because they will, if they want to remain cost neutral, they will need to renegotiate all of those rates for all of those contractors, because they can't start deducting their new tax, which is the employer's NI part of this whole legislation. They can't start deducting that from the contractor's rate on any lawful basis. If they do, then it's a very easy win for a contractor to take them to court to say, give me that money back. And we're starting to actually see, I guess, the equivalent of ambulance chasers in the market that are looking at this particular aspect, because there's probably quite a bit of money in it. Clients really need to think about what they're going to do with their, what I call them, the transitionals. And contractors need to be educating their clients. So just dialogue needs to start, really.
Yeah. And I think that point about the rate is so important. Contractors should not be agreeing a rate and then having employers' national insurance deducted from that rate. So it has to be really, really clear as to what is agreed for in that rate and who is paying that employer's national insurance bit, because that is key. And that is something that kind of was forgotten when the public sector changes came out. And that should be a lesson to be learned, shouldn't it?
It's a very valuable lesson that should be learned. And I have sympathy for the firms that did get it wrong last time, because if we go back to the original legislation, Chapter 8, IR35, that's been around for 20 years, then it is correct that the employer's NI is deducted from the contractor's rate for that particular piece of legislation.
Right.
But that is not the truth for the new piece of legislation. Employers NI is always paid on top, which you and I tell everybody the whole time, don't we, wherever we're doing these types of presentations. Now, it didn't help the HMRC and the Treasury and all of their rhetoric to sell this to MPs were saying nothing has changed except who does the assessment. They didn't tell people that there was this problem about rates being needing to be renegotiated. So why would you have known? Why would you have even thought that there would have been this tax bomb just basically sitting there waiting to go off? You wouldn't have known that unless someone had told you. And to be fair, at the start, people weren't being told this. But now we've had another year. It would surprise me if there were any firms that were still telling any contractors that employers NI needed to be deducted from their rates. I mean, that would just be crazy. That's a slam dunk win in court, really. The other thing we can say about rates is key information documents.
Of course. I meant to mention that. Well done. Yeah. What is a key information document?
A key information document is a breakdown of how much money is being paid to the contractor, who's paying what taxes and everything. And it's something that in law must be provided by the agency. The law came in April 2020. I'm not sure all agencies got on board with it at that point because they had other concerns.
But
contractors can ask for the key information document when they're considering a particular contract, and that should detail what everyone's getting paid and so on. So then they really know what the rate is, because sometimes the rate is defined, that is written as your rate, the contractor's rate, the umbrella rate, the limited company rate, the assignment rate. I mean, it's just made up. So the key information document will give the contractor the actual detail of what they're going to get paid.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I can't believe I was going to end the chat without mentioning that. And it's really for anyone who has a recruitment agency between them and the clients, then you absolutely must by the law be receiving a key information document that will outline all of the deductions from the agreed rate. If there is no recruitment agency between you and the client, then you're negotiating directly with the client anyway, so you shouldn't need that key information document. Important point.
And I think if someone is negotiating directly with the client and the client has decided that they don't want to hire the person on a PSC, they are more likely to probably just hire them on a fixed term employment contract.
Yeah.
So there won't be any need for key information documents and so on.
Exactly. And of course, the thing to remember is being inside IR35 or being on payroll is not in itself a bad thing. It's all about what you, the contractor, will find acceptable in terms of your level of take-home pay. And the unfairness comes in where decisions are being made that might reduce your pay to such a level that it's a problem.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, ultimately, you either decide to take the contract or you don't.
Yeah.
And market forces are in play.
Yeah.
And maybe you won't be earning as much as you were in the past, or maybe it will just all turn out to be okay.
Yeah. And maybe any reduction in your income might only be short term, because I know that when the changes came in the public sector, we saw all sorts of different things, and then kind of the market settled down after a period of time.
Yeah, I think this will be very much a short thing. I would imagine, when I say short, I think things will probably shake out in the first year, and by the end of year two, the market will probably be settled down and bedded in.
Yeah.
Lots of the freelancers who were perhaps deemed employees anyway, they may well have gone back to permanent employment.
Yeah.
So the market of genuinely outside contractors will shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rates will probably go up again, because there's less people who are prepared to do the work and travel and so on. And the market will just adjust itself, as it always does. And for those companies that insist on payroll only, they might find they just have to pay more to get the talent that they want.
Yeah, because that's
so a couple of years, the fuss will be over, I would imagine.
Yeah. That's a decision for that hiring firm to make, isn't it? And I think once businesses are used to the change, which is considering IR35 each and every time they're bringing a contractor into their business, then I think things will even out. It will become almost the normal. Well, it will have to be the norm in bringing in those people to do short-term work.
Yeah, yeah. I think after a couple of years, we'll wonder what the fuss was all about.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time and for sharing your expertise. I'm going to talk to you afterwards about putting some resources together on the listening notes and that sort of thing, and also a link to your book, which is a very helpful resource as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to All About Self-Employment, hosted by Julia Kermode. For more information on today's discussion, please visit iwork.co.uk, where you can also join our growing community. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, then we would love you to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. We'll be back at the same time next week.